Tentor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War, by Michael C.C. Adams, narrated by Mitch Crawford. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Julia Ward Howe, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, 1861. Preface. This book paints a graphic picture of the dark side of the Civil War, its pain, heartbreak, and tragedy. It describes the vicious nature of combat, the terrible infliction of physical and mental wounds, the misery of soldiers living amid corpses, filth, and flies. It also concerns the many civilians who endured loss, deprivation, and violations. To understand what the people of that time endured, I have relied heavily on bringing back their candid voices from the hushed past. That these eyewitnesses deserve to be heard again constitutes a core conviction of this book. Because I want them to speak for themselves, I have neither corrected people's grammar nor interrupted their thoughts with that unpleasant expletive, sick, supposedly needed to flag linguistic errors. Instead, I rely on the listener's common sense to grasp the intended meaning of writings through which our forebears sought to reveal what they experienced. To achieve immediacy, I have at times attempted to create a sense of live action, as though we are experiencing an episode on camera. This technique begins in the opening, where we piggyback on Stephen Crane's arresting image of a road that moves with wounded soldiers shambling to the rear, in order to conjure for ourselves a gallery of Americans journeying together down the path of war. Just as Crane's road was not actually in motion, we will not really sprint down a neurasthenia ward with the animated Dr. Weir Mitchell. Nor would we in fact meet individual men from so many different units clustered together as we and they grope through the smoke on a firing line. We are staging a reconstruction, a reenactment, but one in which the players are the original participants. This modest stylistic device in no way distorts or detracts from the original documents, and I hope will prove valuable to the listener. Opening. Jim Conklin and General Sherman. My teenager years in the United Kingdom coincided with the centennial of the American Civil War. For me, the remembrance meant that I could acquire paperbacks normally unavailable to the general reader. Henry Kidd Douglas's I Rode with Stonewall, the memoirs of General Ulysses S. Grant, and the recollections of Confederate Admiral Raphael Semmes. I held a rather innocent view of the war at this time. I harbored romantic notions of dramatic exploits on the battlefield, of boys being forged into men through the ultimate test of combat. In part, Stephen Crane's 1895 novel, The Red Badge of Courage, inspired my vision. I read it in the Classics Illustrated graphic version around the impressionable age of 12, then went on to devour the complete written text, and to see John Huston's evocative 1951 black-and-white movie, in which Audie Murphy played the Green Youth, transformed by the transcendent experience of battle. Henry Fleming's ascent into heroism seized my imagination. In due course, I went to college and graduate school, where I wrote a dissertation on the war that became my 1978 book, Our Masters, the Rebels. In this work, I argued that Union generals, particularly in the East, had a tendency to talk and act as though awed by their rebel opponents, whom they perceived as being from a more martial culture than their own. Their inferiority complex, as we might loosely label it, meant Federal Army commanders lacked offensive spirit, displaying undue caution. Afflictions of the slows even affected their ability to follow up defensive successes, such as at Gettysburg. I still think the thesis has merit, but I now see other reasons why generals were unable to capitalize when an enemy retreated. their own victorious forces often became too broken and wearied to mount effective pursuit. Today, my teenage images of battle-hardened veterans, endlessly enduring and consistently gallant, succored and sustained by stoic, long-suffering civilians, seem naive and misleading. I understand why Audie Murphy, a veteran who had seen more than enough combat in World War II, found Henry's flag-waving antics after returning to the regiment bitterly silly, and why, during shooting breaks, he wandered off the set as though lost in a distant dream. He had the 2,000-yard stare of the emotionally spent combat soldier. He said as much, recalling, "Before the war, I'd get excited and enthused about a lot of things, but not anymore." In a sense, this development in my understanding mirrors the journey from ignorance to enlightenment described by another combat veteran, General William Tecumseh Sherman. Speaking to a crowd of admirers at the Ohio State Fair on August 11, 1880, Sherman pointedly addressed young people in the crowd, asserting, "There is many a boy here today who looks on war as all glory, but, boys, it is all hell." The general carefully added that he did not espouse pacifism and would serve again if needed, but he urged people to look squarely at war's horrors. I want to stay with this point. I propose that we not go forward to watch Henry Fleming marching exuberantly off the field. He should not look quite so cheerful anyway, as his next rendezvous with battle will be Gettysburg. Instead of moving on, let us dwell a while on the pains, the fears, and the blighted lives, indeed the tragedies of those who became the war's victims, like Jim Conklin, Crane's decent, tall soldier, shot through the body, milling along amid a crowd of other wounded, afraid of being run down by the artillery, wanting to be left alone to die. Jim experienced no transcendence, caught up in the mangle of war, along with many thousands of other men, women, and children. I am by no means the first author to argue for looking starkly at the grim features of the war. Walt Whitman, who worked in Washington, D.C. during the conflict and served as a volunteer hospital nurse, said the real war, the cruel war, would not get into the books. But he tried in his prose and poetry to add some darker shadows. Much later, the distinguished historian Alan Nevins exhorted us to confront the war's hard reality. "We should probe more deeply into roots, a process that will expose some of the weaknesses of our social fabric and governmental system. We should pay fuller attention to its darker aspects and examine more honestly such misinterpretations as the statement it was distinguished by its generosity of spirit, the magnanimity with which the combatants treated each other. A statement absurd on its face, for no war which lasts 4 years and costs 600,000 lives leaves much magnanimity in its later phases. We should above all examine more closely the effects of the great and terrible war, not on the nation's politics, we also know that, but on its character, the vital element of national life." My concerns are not coterminous with those of my distinguished predecessor, although I have become preoccupied, as he was, by the societal aspects of the war more than its politics. Also like him, I do not wish to deny the great issues involved and civic virtue shown, the fighting that produced prodigious courage, sacrifice, endurance, and magnanimity among soldiers and civilians. But I believe strongly that Professor Nevins correctly urged us to dwell more on the dark side. We should remind ourselves now and then about the grimmer realities of this struggle and, perhaps by extension, all armed conflicts. Many books consider in depth this or that important aspect of the bleak war. I hope to perform a service by pulling together all the strands into one large tapestry. The sesquicentennial presents the opportunity to do this, as once again we celebrate the conflict, a word I suspect could not be less appropriate. To begin with, the Civil War's cardinal characteristic became its stunning bloodiness. It may be a commonplace, yet it still shocks us to remember that the fight cost as many lives as all of America's other major wars combined. Equally startling, the Butcher's Bill came for a contest neither sharply delineated nor fought by combatants bonded together in defense of clearly enunciated positions and universally held ideologies. The politics of division proved so complex, confusing, contradictory, and tangled that even today we hotly debate the reasons for the war. Of course, it would be satisfying if we could find one single straightforward explanation for the war. We try. Thus, one camp sees a clear-cut moral struggle between the forces of slavery and freedom. Agreed, slavery must have been a large factor, probably the biggest one, in the coming of the conflict. After all, the election as president of Abraham Lincoln, who opposed the further extension of slavery, led South Carolina fire eaters to kick the lid off the cauldron and jump inside. Yet, say skeptics, Northern opposition to slavery stayed so lukewarm that Lincoln did not even propose partial emancipation until fall 1862, and then not as a moral crusade, but as a military measure to put new life into the flagging war effort. Many white Northerners embraced racism as much as the next bigot. Free blacks could not vote in much of the North, and several Midwestern states excluded African Americans from living within their borders. Some who downplay the debate over slavery counterclaim that the primary cause of the war may be found in Northern encroachment on Southern rights. Confederates fought a disinterested battle to uphold the principle of a state's right to resist centralized intrusion. Local rights included secession from the Union. Again, the argument has some merit. Whether state or national authority should be paramount got a good airing during the war. But making this legal disagreement the focus of the contest still presents the problem that people do not normally precipitate a bloodbath to test an abstract constitutional principle. Appeals to state sovereignty usually masked other, more pragmatic interests. Southerners embraced states' rights when convenient, but insisted that national authorities return fugitive slaves, overriding the states' rights protest of Northern local officials. Trying to broaden the debate, another school argued that we see an epic confrontation between an aristocratic agrarian South and a bourgeois business-industrial North doomed to collide. Charles and Mary Beard championed this argument between the world wars. It gained popularity both with Marxist historians and conservative apologists for the Old South. There must be some validity to the idea of rising industrial interests squaring off against older entrenched agricultural concerns. But farmers and factory owners do not necessarily have to shoot each other over negotiable issues such as the height of protective tariffs. Midwestern farmers stayed loyal to the Union. The only aspect of Southern agrarianism distinct enough to provoke a war remained plantation slavery. It lay at the base of the Southern way of life. Even though a majority of white people in Dixie might not own slaves, they subscribed to the caste system and could not conceive of a state of society in which blacks were free, let alone equal. So the argument turns full circle, and the ravel of causes remains. If we could say one thing with certainty, it would be that the war represented a profound failure of the political system. Discord had broken government. The war does not qualify as a classic tragedy fated to happen. The British Empire had abolished slavery peacefully between 1833 and 1838. Russian Tsar Alexander II ended serfdom without civil war in 1861. Only when the South closed its mind to rational debate of the peculiar institution late in the antebellum period did compromise become impossible in the United States, as Clement Eden pointed out in The Freedom of Thought Struggle in the Old South, 1940. John Brown's 1859 raid on the U.S. Armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, although failing to spark a slave revolt, finished driving many Southerners into paranoia. When statesmanship failed, the calamity fell on a people with lives already steeped in hardship and loss. Victorian life, while not idyllic, still led many to see themselves at the apex of human development. They could evidence an intellectual flowering in New England, the polished manners of some Southern gentry, and the growing dynamism of the West that bred vigorous newcomers like the Lincolns, Shermans, and Grants. The rise of the common man meant that more white males voted than ever before. Mass production enhanced daily life with cheap, plentiful goods, from ready-made furniture and clothing to newspapers and books. The middle class expanded, and the prosperous lived well. Yet the mass of people did not. The scientific concept of a balanced nutritional diet, for example, scarcely existed. Many Southern yeomen, along with most poor whites and blacks, subsisted on a vitamin-deficient diet of cornmeal, molasses, and salt pork, leavened by occasional seasonal boilings of greens or beans. Urban workers had neither the time nor money to eat properly, their food often stale, badly cooked, monotonous. Fanny Fern, a pioneering female journalist, wrote in 1855 of cheap boarding houses where clerks, apprentices, and seamstresses bolt their meals with railroad velocity amid soiled tablecloths, sticky crockery, oily cookery. Ice for refrigeration remained scarce. Harriet Beecher Stowe, enduring humid June heat, complained, "I am sick of the smell of sour milk and sour meat and sour everything." Heavy, restrictive dress proved hard to keep clean and impeded overall health. Vests and frock coats encased men like stovepipes. Women's stays constricted the lungs, while layers of pantaloons and petticoats dragged in the muck and caught fire in parlor fireplaces. Poor physical specimens abounded, as Army surgeons examining recruits in 1861 could attest. Medical practice stayed close to medieval. Young Sarah Morgan, partially paralyzed when her buggy overturned, endured frequent medical hot cupping and bleeding. "The doctor," she screamed, "has again been murdering me." Drugs to combat disease remained inadequate. A physician lost his daughter to convulsions, having only mustard plasters to fight the illness. Class proved no guarantee against sudden death. Mary and Abraham Lincoln, Verena and Jefferson Davis, Ellen and William T. Sherman, Mary and Robert E. Lee all lost children, as did other prominent couples. Known drugs, heroic remedies, had drastic side effects. Calomel and blue pills, commonly available mercury compounds used to treat bowel disorders, typhoid fever, and much else, produced gum disorders and kidney disease. Chloroform, prescribed for insomnia, and arsenic, found in widely advertised and readily available patent nostrums, killed. Because bacteriology remained in its infancy, public hygiene languished. Cities like Chicago, Baltimore, and Louisville had negligible sewer arrangements. Scavenger pigs ate waste thrown in the streets and became emboldened to attack workers' children. For the poor and vulnerable, such as children under 5, death rates stayed high. Typhus, cholera, and yellow fever struck hard. Almost 8,000 people died in the 1853 New Orleans yellow fever outbreak. The 1849 cholera epidemic killed 5,000 New Yorkers alone. Only 2% of city homes had a water line that might have helped stop this waterborne disease. Rural areas also had no immunity. People built privies too close to kitchens, and animal waste fouled groundwater. At Fort Riley, Kansas, in 1855, cholera killed the commandant's wife and 14 others in one day. the accelerating pace of life added to physical and emotional stress. The telegraph enhanced communication, but had unforeseen consequences, demanding radical human adjustments to technology. For example, the speed of the wire created havoc with military planning. A journalist could inform his newspaper of army movements virtually as they happened. An enemy agent might then relay the information to his side. Infuriated generals put reporters behind the lines or threatened execution. Steam power, applied to travel, propelled railroad locomotives, paddle boats, and screw-driven ships. But heightened speed jangled the nerves of people used to a horse's pace. Trains created air and noise pollution. Henry David Thoreau, seeking solitude at Walden Pond, heard wildlife agitated for hours after an engine roared through. The machine had invaded the garden. Disasters occurred frequently. Cows on the line derailed cars, foreshadowing interstate pileups. Fast steamers blew up. Charles Dickens, voyaging to America, depicted the ship's boiler as a fire in hiding, ready to burst through any outlet, wild with its restless power of ruin and death. In an 1865 shocker, the steamer Sultana, taking home Union prisoners of war, exploded, killing 1,700. To alleviate stress and seize a modicum of comfort, Americans used tobacco with abandon, snuffing, chewing, and lighting up. New Yorkers smoked 75 million cigars a year. People guzzled alcohol freely, along with readily available mood-enhancing drugs. Laudanum conveniently infused the two stimulants and proved handy for keeping children quiescent, daycare being virtually unknown outside of prosperous nurseries. Excessive imbibing caused debilitation, violence, and family abuse. One contemporary estimate had 60,000 homes ruined by drink per year. Drunken brawling infected Congress. In one 1857 scrimmage, a colleague knocked inebriated Representative Lawrence Kite of South Carolina across two tables, a shoe taking off in mid-flight. Americans regarded opium as a beneficial tonic and relaxant. They imported 24,000 pounds through northeastern ports in 1840, rising to 105,000 pounds by 1860. For women, with lives severely restricted by gender roles, opium served a similar function to Valium, prescribed in the 1950s for bored and depressed housewives. Alice James, sister of Henry and William, suffered attacks of neuralgia bordering on hysteria. Too bright for her stifling role, she fantasized knocking her father's head off while he sat stiffly reading. Instead, she resorted to self-medication, as did Mary Boykin Chestnut, one of the sharpest minds of the period. Denied the active public life of her senator husband, James, she struggled against overuse of opium and its derivative, morphine. We consider the 19th century a simpler, saner, more grounded time than our own, yet it looks similar in many ways. A grave equality gap existed between rich and poor. Hostility to immigrants manifested itself in a nativist movement. People found distraction in coarse entertainments such as freak shows, cockfights, gambling, and bare-knuckle boxing. They followed the latest fashions and fads. Prominent British personalities exercised their fascination. The public avidly followed the indiscretions of the randy Prince of Wales or the handsome stage star, Frances Anne Fanny Kemble. Their faces adorned engravings, mugs, and handkerchiefs, to be superseded in 1861 by pinups of generals. Youth did not necessarily behave better. Bachelor young men rioted in their off hours, fighting pit bulls, getting stewed, and joining violent gangs. Elders protested against the fecklessness of their juniors. James Henry Hammond, a seaboard planter, called his boys dead weights that only hunted and fished. They growl, grumble, sulk, and do nothing, he complained. We easily exaggerate Victorian sexual probity. Limited contraception produced unwanted pregnancies. One physician estimated in 1860 that 20% of such cases terminated in abortion. Venereal disease thrived alongside prostitution. Many women without male support felt obliged to sell themselves for food. They faced an alternative of underpaid domestic service, with the threat of being forced by male household members or doing work in factories with typical 14-hour days and minimal safety standards. Accidents in plants occurred frequently due to owner negligence. New York attorney George Templeton Strong recorded in his diary on January 11, 1860, that in Lawrence, Massachusetts, a huge factory, long notoriously insecure and ill-built, suddenly collapsed into a heap of ruins. Some 500 or 600 operatives went down with it, young girls and women mostly. Strong wondered if Southern slaveholders could possibly treat their workers any worse than did the misanthropes of the North. The attorney had a point. Poor life expectancy and bad working conditions in the industrial North and in England often exceeded those on the plantation. But one factor separated slaves' status from any other and made it uniquely awful. They were property. This allowed Lincoln to quip that although many held slavery to be a good, none wanted it for themselves. State and national authorities deprived slaves of all civil and human rights. The U.S. Supreme Court held that they could not seek redress in court. They could not testify against a white. Slaves found themselves denied education, beaten, raped, and mutilated with impunity. The auction block separated slave families forever. Uncle Tom in Harriet Beecher Stowe's 1852 novel endures the grim fate of being sold away from his loved ones downriver to Louisiana. There, Simon Legree, a New England Yankee, that complexity again, exploits land and people with equal callousness, thrashing Tom to death. Possibly while working a flatboat to New Orleans, Lincoln developed his repugnance to the peculiar institution, and, of course, South Carolina's hostility to Old Abe precipitated America's most destructive war. Just how bloody became this conflict that engulfed the troubled land? Perhaps as many as 620,000 military died, 360,000 from the North, 260,000 from the South. To give some context, soldiers had a 1 in 4 chance of dying, versus 1 in 126 for Korea. Civil War military fatalities outnumbered U.S. losses in World War II by 50%. The statistics jar us even more if we consider losses as a percentage of population. A reliable estimate holds that at least 2% of Americans alive in 1860 died in uniform. This translates to more than 6 million today. Union losses represented 1.6% of loyal state residents, the equivalent of 4.8 million now. Rebel dead, at 2.9% of white and black folk, equates to a stunning 8.7 million currently. And these figures fail to address the thousands that were physically or mentally maimed, or the civilians who suffered loss, malnutrition, displacement, death. I intend to place center stage the dark side of the war glimpsed in these figures. Author William Dean Howells said that Americans will only embrace tragedy if it ends happily. This implies that we must march on with Henry, wrapped in his red badge of courage. But I believe listeners will wish to stay back with me for a while, walking along that road where poor Jim Conklin staggers by amid a torrent of hurt humanity. Broken-hearted Mary Lincoln weeps beside Verena Davis, and peppery General Sherman peers into hell. In the 8 chapters that follow, we will escort the listener down the dirty, dusty road of war, in a logical progression from military enlistment to camp, then on the march to the battle.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?